Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Russian officials are investigating Sunday's crash of a plane that burst into flames during an emergency landing. The crash killed 41 people. The national airline Aeroflot operated the passenger plane, a Russian-built Sukhoi Superjet 100. The crash happened shortly after the plane took off from Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. The plane was to fly to the northern city of Murmansk. Within minutes, the pilots requested an emergency landing. Video shared on social media shows the plane coming down for a hard landing. As it slid down the runway, the back of the aircraft burst into flames. After coming to a stop, large flames as well as thick black smoke rose from the plane. Russian Transportation Minister Yevgeny Dytryk reported that 41 bodies were recovered from the wreckage. He said 37 people survived the crash. Some of the survivors could be seen on video jumping down an airfield slide from the front of the plane. Russian media reported one of the pilots said lightning had struck the plane. Flight attendant Tatiana Kasatnika said in a video on YouTube that the plane had taken off in a storm. Before the crash, she said she heard a loud noise and saw a burst of light. "We took off, got into a cloud. There was strong hail," the flight attendant said. "And at that moment, there was a pop and some kind of flash, like electricity." Russia's main investigative committee said the plane's flight recorders were recovered from the burned wreckage. A spokeswoman for the committee told Russian news agencies Monday that investigators were looking into three main possible causes: inexperienced pilots, equipment failure, and bad weather. One survivor praised the plane's flight attendants for helping save him and others. "It was dark, and there was gas, a very high temperature. They helped people out of there, helped them to descend," Dmitry Klebnikov told a Russian newspaper. Another passenger, Mikhail Savchenko, wrote on Facebook that some passengers grabbed their belongings as they fled during the emergency. "I do not know what to say about people who ran out with bags. God is their judge," he wrote. The Sukhoi Superjet 100 aircraft first entered service in 2011. It was introduced as a major new replacement for outdated passenger planes designed during times of the Soviet Union. But the plane has been troubled in the past by concerns over problems with its horizontal stabilizers. In 2017, Russian officials ordered an inspection of all superjets in Russia because of the problems. A Mexican airline, Interjet, grounded superjets in December 2016 over the issues. Transportation Minister Dietrich told reporters Monday it was too early to decide whether the planes should be grounded in Russia. I'm Brian Lynn.
Here's what's trending today. Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, gave birth to a baby boy on Monday. The proud father, Britain's Prince Harry, announced to the world that this little baby is absolutely to die for. The baby is the couple's first child. He is the seventh in line to the British throne. The boy was born in the early morning hours Monday, weighing 3.2 kilograms. The royal family said both Meghan and the baby are healthy and well. Prince Harry spoke with television reporters later on Monday in Windsor. He said he was present for the birth. He promised he would offer more details in the coming days, such as the baby's name. "It's been the most amazing experience I could ever have possibly imagined," he said. "How any woman does what they do is beyond comprehension." Queen Elizabeth and other members of the royal family were reportedly delighted with the news. Harry's brother, Prince William, and his wife, Kate, have appeared for photographers just hours after the births of their three children. But Harry and Meghan announced the birth of their first child on Instagram. "It's a boy. Their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, are overjoyed to announce the birth of their child." Harry added that he planned to make another announcement so everyone can see the baby. They are also expected to appear for photographs at that time. The new royal baby is the eighth great-grandchild of the 93-year-old Queen Elizabeth. The child does not immediately become a prince. Only the queen can give him such a title. Many observers feel the birth of the mixed-race baby represents an important moment in royal history. Royal watcher Claudia Joseph told Reuters, "It's symbolic of a more modern monarchy. It appeals to people across the world. They will be able to identify with the royal family as never before." And that's what's trending today. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In many parts of the world, spring is in full bloom. Flowers of all colors and shapes can be seen in gardens, parks, and other green spaces. They make our world look and smell better. So it is no surprise that people love flowers. Well, except for one. Dandelions. There is probably no flower more hated or misunderstood than the bright yellow dandelion. In the United States, they are considered weeds, the name for any unwanted plant. In an effort to have the perfect green grass lawn, people try their best to kill all dandelions with chemical products, or they dig them out at the roots, only to see them grow right back. Dandelions are hard to kill, and that is a good thing because they are actually one of the most nutritious foods in the world. That's right, dandelion haters. The most hated flower on earth is one of the healthiest to eat. A 2014 study ranks dandelion greens as one of the top 41 most nutritious foods. Coming in at number 16, the wild-growing weed topped popular foods like kale and broccoli. The lead writer of that study is Jennifer DeNoia, a professor and researcher at William Patterson University. She is an expert in nutrition and healthy behaviors. In an interview with the university's television studio, DeNoia explained her goal for the study. She said she wanted to develop a method for defining powerhouse fruits and vegetables. These are the foods most strongly linked with reducing chronic disease risk. She added that she also wanted to give people an exact list of fruits and vegetables that offer them the most nutrition. Oftentimes, she explained, people hear they should eat leafy greens or add more color to their diet, but they do not always know how to bring that information to their meal planning. Based on scientific literature and a huge database that lists the nutrients of all foods, DeNoia picked 41 foods with the highest content of 17 nutrients. To pick these 17 nutrients, she used research from the U.S. Institute of Medicine and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Those nutrients are potassium, fiber, protein, calcium, iron, thiamine, riboflavin, folate, niacin, zinc, and vitamins A, B6, B12, C, D, E, and K. Her study was published in Preventing Chronic Disease by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dandelions are a great source of vitamin K and also are a good source of vitamins A and C. They also have vitamin E, folate, and small amounts of other B vitamins. Also, they provide lots of iron, calcium, magnesium, and potassium. In her book, Eating on the Wild Side, writer Joe Robinson says that compared to spinach, dandelion leaves have 8 times more antioxidants, 2 times more calcium, 3 times more vitamin A, and 5 times more vitamin K and vitamin E. Besides nutrition, another great thing about dandelions is that you can eat every part of them, from the bottom of the roots to the top of the flower. Just make sure to take care when picking wild dandelions. Do not eat ones that have been treated with dangerous chemicals or are growing near high traffic areas. You can eat dandelion greens either raw or cooked. My Italian grandfather used to collect the greens for dinner. He would use the flowers to make dandelion wine. You can also soak the flowers or roots in hot water to make dandelion tea. Dandelions are said to provide several possible health benefits, such as helping in digestion and improving some skin conditions. They may also reduce inflammation. But research on these health benefits is either non-existent or has been done on animals. So we still have a lot to learn about how to best use dandelions. However, experts do know the vitamins, minerals, and compounds found in dandelions are good for human health. the health benefits of fiber are also well known. The root of the dandelion is rich in fiber and may help to support the balance of bacteria in your digestive system. Dandelions are hardy, drought-resistant flowers. They can grow in environments too dry or difficult for most other crops. One reason they are so hard to kill is that their roots spread easily, as do their white, soft, seed-filled tops. Here is another reason to love dandelions. Children in many parts of the world have had the simple pleasure of blowing the soft, white dandelion tops. They watch the seeds float easily in the air. In fact, there is a game children play with dandelions that have gone to seed. Pick the white top, make a wish, close your eyes and blow. If you blow all of the seeds off in one breath, your wish will come true. Well, that is what many children believe. Even if the wish does not come true, at least the seeds have traveled far and wide, letting more of this nutritious food source continue to grow. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1920s are remembered as a quiet period in American foreign policy. The nation was at peace. Americans elected three Republican presidents in a row: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. These conservatives in the White House were generally more interested in economic growth at home than in relations with other countries. But the United States had become a world power. It was tied to other countries by trade, politics, and shared interests. And America had gained new economic strength. Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith discuss American foreign policy during the 1920s.
Before World War I, foreigners invested more money in the United States than Americans invested in other countries, about $3 billion more. The war changed this. By 1919, Americans had almost $3 billion more invested in other countries than foreign citizens had invested in the United States. American foreign investments continued to increase greatly during the 1920s. Increased foreign investment was not the only sign of growing American economic power. By the end of World War I, the United States produced more goods and services than any other nation, both in total and per person. Americans had more steel, food, cloth, and coal than even the richest foreign nations. By 1920, the United States' national income was greater than the combined incomes of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, and 17 smaller countries. Quite simply, the United States had become the world's greatest economic power.
America's economic strength influenced its policies toward Europe during the 1920s. In fact, one of the most important issues of this period was the economic aid the United States had provided European nations during World War I. Americans lent the Allied countries $7 billion during the war. Shortly after the war, they lent another $3 billion. The Allies borrowed most of the money for military equipment and food and other needs of their people. The Allied nations suffered far greater losses of property and population than the United States during the war. And when peace came, they called on the United States to cancel the loans America had made. France, Britain, and the other Allied nations said the United States should not expect them to repay the loans.
The United States refused to cancel the debts. President Coolidge spoke for most Americans when he said simply, "They borrowed the money." He believed the European powers should pay back the war loans, even though their economies had suffered terribly during the fighting. However, the European nations had little money to pay their loans. France tried to get the money by demanding payments from Germany for having started the war. When Germany was unable to pay, France and Belgium occupied Germany's Ruhr Valley. As a result, German miners in the area reduced coal production. And France and Germany moved toward an economic crisis and possible new armed conflict.
An international group intervened and negotiated a settlement to the crisis. The group provided a system to save Germany's currency and protect international debts. American bankers agreed to lend money to Germany to pay its war debts to the Allies. And the Allies used the money to pay their debts to the United States.
Some Americans with international interests criticized President Coolidge and other conservative leaders for not reducing or canceling Europe's debts. They said the debts and the new payment plan put foolish pressure on the weak European economies. They said this made the German currency especially weak, and they warned that a weak economy would lead to serious social problems in Germany and other countries. However, most Americans did not understand the serious effect that international economic policies could have on the future of world peace. They believed that it was wrong for the Europeans, or anyone, to borrow money and then refuse to pay it back.
Many Americans of the 1920s also failed to recognize that a strong national military force would become increasingly important in the coming years. President Coolidge requested very limited military spending from the Congress. And many conservative military leaders refused to spend much money on such new kinds of equipment as submarines and airplanes. Some Americans did understand that the United States was now a world power and needed a strong and modern fighting force. One general, Billy Mitchell, publicly criticized the military leadership for not building new weapons. But most Americans were not interested. Many Americans continued to oppose arms spending until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941.
American policy toward the League of Nations did not change much in the 1920s. In 1919, the Senate denied President Wilson's plea for the United States to join the new League of Nations. The United States, however, became involved unofficially in a number of League activities. But it continued to refuse to become a full member. And in 1930, the Senate rejected a proposal for the United States to join the World Court. The United States also continued in the 1920s to refuse to recognize the communist government in Moscow. However, trade between the Soviet Union and the United States increased greatly during this period. And such large American companies as General Electric, DuPont, and RCA provided technical assistance to the new Soviet government.
The Coolidge administration was involved actively in events in Latin America. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes helped several Latin American countries to settle border disputes peacefully. In Central America, President Coolidge ordered American Marines into Nicaragua when President Adolfo Diaz faced a revolt from opposition groups. The United States gave its support to more conservative groups in Nicaragua, and it helped arrange a national election in 1928. American troops stayed in Nicaragua until 1933. However, American troops withdrew from the Dominican Republic during this period. And Secretary of State Hughes worked to give new life to the Pan-American Union.
Relations with Mexico became worse during the 1920s. In 1925, Mexican President Plutarco Elias Calles called for laws to give Mexico more control over its minerals and natural wealth. American oil companies resisted the proposed changes. They accused Calles of communism, and some American business and church leaders called for armed American intervention. However, the American Senate voted to try to settle the conflict peacefully, and American diplomat Dwight Morrow helped negotiate a successful new agreement.
These American actions in Nicaragua and Mexico showed that the United States still felt that it had special security interests south of its border. But its peaceful settlement of the Mexican crisis and support of elections in Nicaragua showed that it was willing to deal with disputes peacefully. America's policies in Latin America during the 1920s were in some ways similar to its policies elsewhere. It was a time of change, of movement, from one period to another. Many Americans were hoping to follow the traditional foreign policies of the past. They sought to remain separate from world conflict.
The United States, however, could no longer remain apart from world events. This would become clear in the coming years. Europe would face fascism and war. The Soviet Union would grow more powerful. And Latin America would become more independent. The United States was a world power, but it was still learning in the 1920s about the leadership and responsibility that is part of such power.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.